And now,
the state of Iraq today is poor.
That's Senate testimony this morning from Iraq expert Michael O'Hanlon of the Brookings Institution. Today we're looking at what the players in Washington are saying about the new way forward in Iraq, and we're going to hear more Senate testimony. But first, as President Bush prepares for his much-anticipated speech tonight, it's been well leaked that he will propose a surge in troops. It's now being reported that he will acknowledge that it was a mistake not to have more troops initially. We'll have more on that as well. Democrats and Republicans are divided over how to react to the speech. Not all Republicans agree with what Bush is calling a troop surge. And Democrats, now in control in Congress, can agree on whether and how to cut off funding for any troop increase, and whether that will make them look as if they're against the troops. Joining us first from Capitol Hill is Gail Chadwick, a congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Gail, we understand Democrats have a meeting behind closed doors. Very active day where you are. What's the latest?
Well, they are certainly agreed on one point, that the term they're going to use to describe this is not surge, which has a kind of temporary quality to it, but escalation. It's an escalation, they say, that that military commanders themselves oppose, and that they, Democrats and as many Republicans as they can bring on board, are going to oppose it. But the form that opposition takes, that's the key point.
Right, and we want to talk about some of the players, but you were telling us earlier this morning that you thought this was sort of a Titanic moment in this discussion on, you know, wither in Iraq. But how is it feeling to you midday? Is it, you know, rearranging the deck chairs, or something really happened?
No, I think they really are in a struggle within the party as to whether or not they're actually going to withdraw funding for the war. Until Sunday, when Speaker Pelosi, for the first time, mentioned that this was an option, every top Democrat I talked to ruled that off the table. There's no way we're going to withdraw support for troops that are in harm's way, they said. But what Democrats are trying to do now is see whether they can parse that. The heart of this is in the House Appropriations Committee with John Murtha, a lot of experience with working with the military and a lot of his own sources in the Pentagon. What he would like to do is hold about 2 months of very detailed hearings that bring key Pentagon officials up to Capitol Hill and talk about readiness. And in the end, what he's expecting to do is to stop funding anything that would lower the level of readiness or send troops back into Iraq that have not had their full year cycle.
But, Gail, isn't that problematic? Because from what we hear, the proposed surge is expected to start next month, and it sounds like Congressman Murtha is talking about it over the next month.
It is a race against time. What he wants is the president's supplemental defense budget as soon as possible. And, of course, that's the key. If the president can delay sending that to Congress or send it in such a general way that it's not grist for the kind of detailed hearings that Murtha is talking about, it could stymie him. So it's very interesting to see a president who's at the lowest approval rating with a country overwhelmingly opposed to anything but getting out of Iraq, still has so many trumps in his hand, especially having to do with timing.
Isn't Congressman Murtha also in opposition, it would seem, to Senator Ted Kennedy, who seems to be proposing flatly cutting off funds for new troops?
Well, what Kennedy is doing is suggesting a resolution that could be voted on very quickly that would require the president to bring back, to come back to the Congress and get a vote authorizing the movement of troops into the field. Now, he defends this by saying this is related to the power of the purse. But he's not an appropriator. He doesn't have the capacity, and he's not talking specifically about what funds would be withdrawn. That's something that Murtha is focused on. He thinks that the only way to do this is through the appropriations process. Think about it for a minute. The Kennedy resolution comes to a vote. It passes with broad bipartisan support. It goes to the president. He vetoes it. It comes back to the Congress. Do they have the two-thirds to overrule that veto? But if Murtha, in his in appropriations bill, manages to write in some constraints on the president that would limit any kind of surge, and it passes with broad bipartisan support, and it goes to the president's desk and he vetoes it, if you veto an appropriations bill, you don't have money. That's why Murtha thinks my way is really the only way with any teeth And he's concerned that if Democrats go for a quick symbolic victory that's going to prove Pyrrhic, that won't stand up, it'll undermine what he's trying to do.
In fact, speaking of a symbolic victory, the online magazine Slate is calling those measures the pale action and timid gesture resolution, that saying just that, that it is non-binding and just symbol. But I want to, when you talk about the appropriation of funds, it's still confusing because Senator Joe Biden said on Meet the Press this Sunday and is still standing by his comments that there is no way constitutionally that Congress can limit the funds that the president can get. How does that fit into this picture?
Most members of Congress I've talked to believe that. But if you talk to constitutional or military historians, they say that, you know, the Congress has very broad powers in the purse. It can do anything it wants, but the fact is, that's on parchment. In practice, it's been done very rarely.
In fact, let's remind ourselves, when has it been done?
The end of the Vietnam War, when Congress outlawed bombing over Laos and Cambodia.
I'm thinking of Lebanon in 1983 as well.
Yeah, Lebanon in 1983 is another example. But these are very, you know, relatively rare instances, given the immense power that Congress actually has given to it in the Constitution. And I think it's politically very difficult. Republicans are already looking at the Democrats, many of whom were elected from conservative districts that gave them the majority, arguing that they would support troops in the field, and they feel that it would be a very tough vote for them if they voted to withdraw troops and later Iraq disintegrated into complete and total chaos.
But to be clear, many Democrats are saying they are only specifically talking about funding for new troops.
That's right, but it's a distinction in practice that's very difficult to make. For example, if part of the surge is keeping people already there longer, do you stop feeding them 2 days after their allotted time to return has expired? You know, it's not as straightforward as it seems. If it was just a matter of putting new people on a boat, that might be one thing. But, you know, that period, that process of troops moving in and out of a war zone is constant, goes on all the time. So what Murtha is saying is we need to get very specific about what the change in mission is, what the funding is to support that change in mission. We can only do that in the context of a new funding request. That is due to come up this spring. Murtha wants it sooner rather than later. But the problem is if the president moves to beef up capacity in Iraq sooner rather than later, the capacity to use this cutting off the funds, the deft way that Murtha would do it, is much more problematic.
Meanwhile, Gail Chadwick, this all comes right in the splat in the middle of the Democrats' new 100 hours plan. This is the democratically controlled Congress and their plan to do almost a bill a day. How is this inter-party squabble affecting Democrats?
On the surface, not at all. This is moving forward like clockwork, at least on the House side. I'm really, as I talk to members, they are really looking for a chance to talk to each other. There's a lot of uncertainty as to where loyalties are going to fall out in this new Congress. Some of the Democratic centrists are still ruling out using any kind of financial clout, appropriations clout. They have to sort that out among themselves. The senators have to talk more to the members of the House and see how much unity Democrats can reach across those two borders. So it's really early. There's so much going on right now. But everyone knows that the biggest item on the agenda of the 110th Congress is Iraq.
Gail Chadwick, congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor in a very busy Washington. Thank you so much, Gail.
You're welcome.
And we are getting reports now that President Bush is planning to move troops into Iraq sooner rather than later. And elsewhere on Capitol Hill, experts on Iraq painted a grim picture of the country and Baghdad, where most troops in any surge to Iraq would go. Senator Joe Biden is holding the first democratically controlled hearings on the Iraq war. Michael O'Hanlon of the Brookings Institution told senators the U.S. is losing in Iraq, but there's still hope for salvaging a better outcome. He also said, though, the daily violence in Iraq is almost as bad as in Saddam Hussein's day.
Iraq is becoming Bosnia, ethnic cleansing and displacement are becoming paramount. 100,000 Iraqis per month are being driven from their homes right now. Roughly half are winding up abroad. Roughly half are moving to different parts of Iraq. This is Bosnia-scale ethnic cleansing.
Well, we want to touch base now with Boston Globe reporter Rick Klein because, Rick, this grim picture comes as news is also breaking out of the White House that the president is going to acknowledge tonight in his speech that it was a mistake not to send more troops to Iraq at the start of the war. That's according to the AP. Seems like a big mea culpa. Why is he saying this now?
I think it's an important political calculation. The president and his advisors know that that their credibility is not what it used to be when it comes to the war. The American people have heard numerous speeches about a new strategy in Iraq, about changes in tactics, about more troops, about fewer troops, about in different regions, and it hasn't worked. So I think the president needs to fall on his sword a bit here and say, I acknowledge that mistakes were made early on, specific mistakes about troop levels, and we're going to try to make it right. And I think that's really the only way that he can hopefully get the support of the Congress and the support of the public back on his side.
One general in particular, General Shinseki, pleading for more troops before the invasion of Iraq, and that was dismissed. By the way, the AP is also reporting that the 1st Brigade of the proposed surge in troops, about 20,000-plus troops, will arrive by next Monday. We just mentioned moments ago it might be next month. What will that quick surge of troops in Iraq do to the Democrats' attempts to try to pull funding from any new troops?
I think it's enormously significant for the timeline. I think Democrats are hoping to be able to digest the speech a bit, to formulate a response. Senator Reid had talked about putting a resolution on the floor next week, not even necessarily voting on it until a few weeks from then. But this is likely to push the whole timeline up considerably. As Senator Kennedy pointed out in putting in his proposal ahead, is if the Congress waits for more troops to be in the field, then the question is going to be, well, do you support those troops or not?
Right.
And very few members of Congress want to say that want to cut off funding for troops that are already there. So really they have maximum leverage. Maybe their only significant leverage is before they go over there. So they're going to have to move extremely quickly if the president's planning on making additional deployments as soon as next week.
And we were just hearing that Congressman Murtha was hoping to debate this for a while and get it through an appropriations committee as opposed to through, let's say, Senator Kennedy's resolution, but that seems like it will take too much time.
Oh, certainly. I mean, that appropriations bill hasn't even been filed yet. So you'd have to take something closer to the Kennedy approach, which is a more proactive step in before the president makes a move, before he makes a funding request, if you actually want to stop it. Now, that doesn't mean that the Democrats will do that. They may just decide to do something non-binding to put themselves on record, but that would, I think, make them look pretty weak in the eyes of some early on in the process to do something just non-binding, not even with the force of law.
Rick Klein, just a couple seconds. We want to note that nowhere are we seeing that the president will make any reference to the Iraq Study Group's request that he have diplomatic relations with Iran and Syria.
That's right. He's ruled that out, and there's no indication. Secretary Rice has said similar things. There's no indication that he's going to change his stance toward those negotiations, and they will not be happening as far as the Bush administration is concerned.
Rick Klein covers Washington for the Boston Globe on this very busy day. Rick, thank you.
Thank you.
And just ahead, the view from Baghdad. Our residents there hunkering down in advance of the president's new plan. Much more coming up here and now. And now, and as we've been saying, President Bush, in his much-anticipated and leaked address to the nation tonight, is expected to propose sending 21,500 additional forces to Iraq and to spend $1.5 billion on reconstruction and job creation. Well, how is Iraq reacting to the president's plan? NPR is reporting that militants in the Shiite stronghold of Sadr City are rumored to be going door to door distributing grenades, with the powerful Mahdi army launching daily attacks. And just yards from the Green Zone, 1,000 American and Iraqi troops battled Sunni insurgents yesterday, leaving at least 50 dead. LA Times correspondent Louise Rogue joins us now from Baghdad. And Louise, let's start in that Sunni neighborhood because you tell of scenes from Haifa Street, which is there, where the violence was. Who lives there?
Well, traditionally, this is a Ba'athist stronghold. During the reign of Saddam Hussein, he would give out free real estate to party officials and also Syrian and Palestinian refugees. And it has been a headache for the U.S. military since 2003.
What do you think has sparked this rise in violence now? Do you think it has anything to do with the fact that President Bush is expected to speak with a new plan?
Well, I think what we're seeing here in Baghdad is a retrenching. It goes for the Shia neighborhoods and it goes for the Sunni neighborhoods. People are hunkering down. The fighters are fortifying themselves in particular neighborhoods and fighting back.
And it plays sort of into the hands of the criticism of a surge in troops in Baghdad, as you well know. Soon to retire General John Ebazaid says that more troops will simply mean more targets and more violence. And it would seem as if many American troops have been made targets in the last couple of days.
Well, I think we have different situations in various parts of the country. Now, if you look at Anbar province, where we have none of the sectarian conflicts that you have in the civil war that's raging in Baghdad, there you have U.S. troops clearly being targets of a Sunni-led nationalist insurgency. In Baghdad, the situation is somewhat more complicated because you have the sectarian nature of the conflict.
Well, and I want to ask you about that because we're seeing in the last couple of days American troops fighting back heavily with airstrikes. You write about eyewitness accounts of U.S. missiles hitting insurgent vehicles in Haifa Street.
Yesterday's operation was a large-scale operation involving about 1,000 Iraqi and American troops. Iraqi troops on their own had been unable to fight the insurgents in that neighborhood and had called upon the Americans for help. And the Americans brought in attack aircraft, including Apache helicopters, and struck at targets there. It was very heavy fighting that could be heard in most of the rest of the city.
Right. But analysts here are saying that whether or not there are more troops in Baghdad isn't the question. The question is whether or not they will dare to go into Sadr City, the Shia stronghold.
Well, we've heard from the Iraqi government that now things are going to be different, that they'll want Iraqi and American forces to go after both Sunni and Shia armed groups. Now, they've said that in the past and then effectively prevented American troops from going into places like Sadr City, home to the Shia militia, the Mahdi army. But it is like Groundhog Day here. Everything old is new again.
Well, let's turn to the second proposal expected from President Bush in his speech tonight, and that is to spend $1.4 billion on reconstruction. And in some ways, it's a different view of reconstruction, not a grand $20 billion project, but smaller projects. For instance, encouraging the Iraqi government to open up shuttered companies, companies with names James Glantz writes about in the New York Times today, names like the General Company for Vegetable Oil and the State Company for Battery Manufacturing. But we're already hearing from Iraqi officials that this is ridiculous because these companies are so destroyed, these state-run companies, and what Iraq needs is less Iraqis on sort of the state dole.
Well, I think one of the ideas behind that is to bring more people into jobs. We have a unemployment here reaching 50%, so a huge unemployment, and that problem becomes a security problem, and that's been argued again and again by both state officials and military commanders. Unemployed men find money by planting roadside bombs, etc.
Working seems to be the key because other Iraqi businessmen are quoted as saying that what's been happening in the past 3 years is that workers are collecting monthly paychecks and going home.
Well, that has been a huge problem, ghost employees on various projects. It's very hard to see how you can combat that when, again, the security is such that Americans can't, in some of the provinces, they can't oversee the work on the site on a day-to-day basis because it's simply too dangerous.
Another aspect of the reconstruction are the provincial reconstruction teams. Your paper writes about this today. They're expected to be central to the new Iraq policy. But haven't we heard about these provincial reconstruction teams before?
Condoleezza Rice unveiled the first provincial reconstruction team in Mosul, I believe it was last year, and they have had mixed success. In certain provinces, in the more peaceful provinces, they have been able to launch projects and get people working. In other provinces, security, again, is so difficult that there's been recommendations that they shut down the provincial reconstruction teams because they have no meaningful contact with the population.
Louise Rogue in Baghdad, I want to ask you about one last question about reconstruction. And we heard it from someone who is a fierce defender of the surge, but also of arresting more Iraqis. He says that is the problem, that the criminal element is allowed to be let loose on the street. This is Bing West, and he said to us, how are jobs going to work if you don't pay someone more than, let's say, the Mahdi army pays them? Is the life of an insurgent more lucrative to an Iraqi right now than a job would be?
Well, I think the problem is you could work for the Americans during the day, but then you could be an insurgent at night. And that has always been the problem in Iraq.
So, Louise Rogue, there in Baghdad, as you prepare also to hear the president's speech tonight, and as Iraqis do, what is the general feeling on the part of Iraqis of, you know, a surge in troops and an offer of more jobs closer to home as opposed to a sort of a grand nationwide reconstruction?
Well, the Iraqis that I've spoken to are quite skeptical. They've heard a lot of this rhetoric before. They don't see how this differs from any other plan that has come from the Americans.
That's Los Angeles Times correspondent Louise Rogue in Baghdad. Louise, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Well, there is other business going on in Washington still to come, the debate over Medicare drugs. And this update on a story we've covered, President Bush has lifted a ban on oil and gas drilling in Alaska's Bristol Bay. Bristol Bay was put off limits to drilling in 1990 after the Exxon Valdez tanker oil spill in nearby Cook Inlet. Leases in the area could be sold as early as 2010 after public comments and environmental impact studies are completed. Stay with us. More ahead here and now. Funding for Here and Now. And as we heard earlier, the House Democrats' 100-hour agenda is on track despite debate on Iraq. Today, they take up the minimum wage bill, legislation that would raise the minimum wage from $5.15 an hour to $7.25. Tomorrow, increasing federal funding for stem cells. Then on Friday, a bill to allow Medicare to negotiate drug prices. Now, Democrats say this bill would lead to lower prices for seniors. Opponents say the marketplace is setting fair drug prices and negotiations would limit the drugs available. President Bush has said he would veto the bill. Well, we're going to start with an opponent to the plan, Dr. Bob Moffitt. He's director of the Center for Health Policy Studies at the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Robin, for having me.
And what is wrong with the government, let's say, strong-arming drug companies for seniors because they do it for the veterans plan? And supporters of negotiations point out that seniors pay 58% more for the same drugs than vets do.
What the House bill is doing is substituting basically government price fixing for a system of private negotiations which exists right now. In Medicare's existing system, private plans secure discounts through the establishment of formularies where individual plans cover some drugs, perhaps not others. Pharmacy benefit managers negotiating on behalf of private plans decide to make a deal with the companies if they decide the price is not appropriate for the market. The competition has led to much lower prices than anybody projected.
But not as low, as we said, supporters of negotiations point out, as the veterans plan, where the government does negotiate the prices. I mean, 58%, that's a lot. 58% more is what seniors pay.
That's a lot. But remember this. In the Veterans Administration program, yes, you can get reduced pricing on drugs, but you also get much more limited access to drugs. That is to say, the Veterans Administration uses drug lists that are restricted.
Well, 2 points there. Even in the vets plan, a patient can get a waiver saying that they do require the drug that is not on the list and most times can get that drug.
That's true.
And the House bill would prohibit negotiators from limiting the types of drugs that are available.
Well, that's true. I mean, what you're talking about is, yes, you can go through an appeals process to get the drug that you want if, in fact, the Veterans Administration won't give it to you. That is another layer of bureaucracy that you would be imposing on senior citizens. The other point, though, that you make is, you know, the congressional leadership is actually saying something that is really quite remarkable. What they're saying is, we want you to negotiate lower drug prices, but the secretary would be forbidden by law to establish a list of preferred drugs. But that is precisely the way in which the VA and other public and private sector firms use to control drug costs.
So you're saying that there seems to be a flaw even in the reasoning of the bill that they won't be able to negotiate because they don't have any leverage.
Think of it this way. They're putting on a kind of impossible a level of achievement for the Secretary of HHS. No wonder he doesn't want to get involved in a negotiation process where, in fact, he can't win.
But couldn't the government use another tactic? Couldn't they strong-arm drug companies by saying, if you don't get in line and lower your prices and help out our country's seniors,
then we won't be as interested in you participating in other government programs.
That's exactly right. That's exactly what they would do. They would use a hammer. The government would say, look, we're going to restrict choices for seniors in Medicare, and in order to make it fair, what we're going to do is we're going to restrict the choices for retired federal employees and federal workers who get their drugs through the federal employee health
benefit program. Senators and such.
That is really a punitive approach. We don't have to do that. This is the one area of Medicare right now that is working quite well.
Bob Moffitt is director of the Center for Health Policy Studies at the Heritage Foundation in Washington. We're speaking about the plan in Congress to allow the government to negotiate drug prices for Medicare Part D right now. That's a private negotiation. Bob, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Well, we now turn to Ron Pollack, Executive Director and Vice President of Families USA. They're an advocacy group, and they are in favor of allowing the government to negotiate drug prices. And Ron, we just heard from Bob Moffitt. Douglas Holt Aikens, the former Congressional Budget Director and often critic of the White House in the past, says the same thing. In effect, the plan is working better than anyone thought. What more would government bring to the table? It's not broke. Don't fix it.
Well, we know that the prices that these so-called Part D plans get are much, much higher than the best example of government negotiating, which is the Department of Veterans Affairs and what they do for veterans. We looked at the top 20 drugs prescribed for seniors. This was not an arbitrary list of drugs. These are the most popular drugs, drugs like Celebrex, Fosamax, Lipitor, Nexium, Zocor. And the median price difference is an astounding 58%.
Well, give us some examples, because they really are amazing. What about Zocor? This is to use to lower cholesterol. What's that comparison?
Well, in Zocor, the VA price is $127. The lowest price that any of these Part D plans get is $1,486. The highest price is $1,694. So it's 11 to 13 times higher. And it means the taxpayer who foots the bill for three-quarters of the cost of the program is getting fleeced. So,
well, but Bob Moffitt and others argue, I mean, it is a huge cost difference, but they argue that the VA has this leverage in negotiations. They can tell a company, if you don't lower your price, you don't get on our preferred list, and companies vie for that. But the House bill doesn't allow a preferred list. So how would the government use negotiations to force down prices? What's their leverage?
Well, there are two things here that give them leverage. First, when the government, Medicare, bargains on behalf of Medicare beneficiaries, it's bargaining on behalf of 43 million people. And mind you, seniors account for 43 cents of every dollar spent on prescription drugs. That's a lot of leverage. But secondly, what Medicare can say is, we won't stop your drug from being available to seniors, but we'll do tiered pricing, which is what is done throughout the private sector. Those drugs that we get a good price for, we'll put in the best tier, and so the co-payments that seniors have to pay will be relatively small. For those drugs that the company gives a lousy price, we'll put them in the top tier, which means that seniors are going to have to pay a very substantial co-payment. And obviously, that's going to mean that fewer seniors are going to choose that particular drug. So there's really a lot of leverage here.
Ron Pollack is Executive Director and Vice President of Families USA. They support the government being allowed to negotiate Medicare drug prices. Ron, even if the House bill, which is in favor of negotiations, passes in the Senate, President Bush has vowed to veto it.
I think the president is ill-advised to veto this legislation. This is very popular. Seniors strongly support allowing bargaining so that they can get cheaper prices, especially when they're in the donut hole. I don't think that the president would be supporting either good policy or good politics if he vetoed the legislation.
Ron Pollack, that'll be the last word. Thank you so much.
Happy to talk to you.
Well, still to come later today, Kate Burton on life choices she made because she was the daughter of Richard Burton. And also, she talks to us about taking the lead in Chekhov's The Cherry Orchard. That's still coming up. You're listening to Here and Now. Dorothy Parker's quip, "Men seldom make passes at girls who wear glasses," convinced many young girls to leave theirs at home and squint through life. Well, Marissa Walsh's new book, Girl with Glasses, Myoptic History, get it? Myoptic History, challenges that notion and celebrates us, GWGs, Girls with Glasses. On a recent stroll through Harvard Square, we found quite a few other GWGs, and they clearly remember their first pair.
They were very hideous.
Do you remember what they looked like?
They were very large frame, kind of like a plasticky pinkish color, I think, and they're very large, and so they kind of took up most of my face.
Fashionable. Yeah, my parents didn't want me to have nerd type of glasses. They were fashionable.
They were the little plastic ones with the blue behind them.
Mine were pink with one frosted lens and an eye patch. Well, what were Marissa Walsh's? Here now is Katie Falsigno, another girl with glasses, met recently with the author.
My first pair was a very big pair of purple plastic glasses from, I guess it was like 1980 is when I got my first pair. So it was one of those big pairs, like in the book I described them as the pair that Dustin Hoffman wore when he dressed in drag to be Dorothy.
Tootsie, take 10.
Huh? My name is Dorothy. It's not Tootsie or Toots or Sweetie or Honey or Dow.
Oh, Christ.
No, just Dorothy.
The interesting thing to me about glasses is that they do become, it's not like earrings or a necklace or a bracelet. Basically, if you buy a pair of glasses, they're part of your face for every day. I mean, this pair I've worn every day for 3 years.
Yeah.
One big theme of the book is that right now, being a girl with glasses is a choice. With LASIK surgery, breathable contacts, with disposable contacts, with all these things that when I was a kid and got glasses, those things weren't available. I mean, now you can sleep with your contacts in if you need to. I think because of that, there is more of a group dynamic where, like, the people who are choosing to be girls with glasses are, you know, do tend to be librarians or teachers or, you know, I worked in publishing for years. There are tons of editors, copy editors are all girls with glasses. You know, I think Tina Fey really represents the modern girl with glasses, you know, this very cool, confident, independent woman. It's been exciting to watch her from the first day that she was on Weekend Update wearing her glasses.
Maxim magazine released its annual Hot 100 list with Eva Longoria at number one, followed by Jennifer Garner and Lindsay Lohan, while I, once again, placed between Bonnie Hunt and Joy Behar.
I feel like for her that those glasses represent this empowerment.
Have glasses ever prevented you from doing something that you've always wanted to do?
Well, I don't know that they've prevented me. In the book, I have this funny list of things that you can't do with glasses. I hate when I go to the beach. You know, if I go into the water, I have to have somebody there who's not swimming to, like, hold my glasses for me.
Mm-hmm.
And then I also don't like not being able to see when I'm swimming. Mm-hmm. You know, growing up in Massachusetts and seeing Jaws, you know, you always have that idea that, like, you're going to be the blind girl in the water and suddenly there's going to be this big thing next to you.
I was talking to my dad earlier, and he's worn glasses all of his life, and he was saying, you know, back then, they didn't have the goggles that you could wear during sports,
exactly.
So he never was able to play football or anything like that. So he was saying that he became more of an individual rather than a team player, that if he had been able to play sports, you know, he kind of did more, you know, individual things, like he played with models and stuff like that.
Right.
Do you think that's
what
kind of shaped you, or you talk about reading a lot in the book?
I don't know that it shaped me as much as it just reinforced who I already was.
Yeah.
Like, in the book, I describe being the class brain, and I was the class brain even before I got glasses. And, I mean, it's sort of cliche to say it, but I guess the glasses did represent sort of the bookish, smart girl.
Because you do say you were born a girl with glasses.
Exactly.
You
didn't
get them until you're
8. Exactly. So I think it was always there.
Now these ladies know the score, forgotten more than phony fashion ever knew. A woman wearing glasses, she's hypnotic like a breakthrough.
Marissa Walsh speaking with Here and Now's Katie Falsigno. Marissa's new book is Girl with Glasses, My Optic History. Stay with us. More ahead here and now.
I want a girl with glasses.
It's Here and Now. Kate Burton was born into acting royalty. Her parents were Richard Burton and actress Sybil Williams Christopher. But she has so forged her own path that some audiences may not even know that. They know her as the Emmy-nominated surgeon struggling with Alzheimer's on the smash TV hit Grey's Anatomy, or the Tony-nominated Broadway actress portraying Hedda Gabler. And now she's center stage once again here in Boston, starring as Madame Ranovskaya in Chekhov's The Cherry Orchard at the Huntington Theater.
I slept in this nursery. I looked out at that orchard. Every morning I woke up happy. Hasn't changed. I'm still like that. White. Oh, white. My orchard.
That's Kate Burton in The Cherry Orchard, and she joins us now in the studio. Welcome.
Thanks.
I was brushing up on my Chekhov to go see the preview the other night. And in so many ways, this play is a part of its time, set in 1904, aristocracy on the wane, a revolution around the corner. But I was so struck with how, in other ways, it was so contemporary. You know, a woman who just doesn't want to sell her beloved trees in order to keep her mansion. How do you see her?
Well, you know, I actually, this is a play that I have a lot of history with, mostly as an audience member. It's the Chekhov play that I've seen the most.
How many times? Do you know?
I think I've seen it at least 7 times.
Now, why is that? Because I was going to ask, and I want to continue to hear about your history with it, but when I went to the previews, it was packed. This is a play that's been around. You know, we know the ending. She has to sell the trees.
Right.
What is it that's so appealing about it?
I think it's, you know, like you say, it's a universal story about how do you let go. And, you know, we've all had different, you know, experiences in our lives of letting go of something that we love very much, but it's really for the best. The thing about Chekhov, or any great playwright, but Chekhov, who's, there is no one like Anton Chekhov, he resonates for you at whatever point you are in your life. I mean, when I was a younger actress, I played all the young girls. I played Nina in The Seagull. I played Anya in The Cherry Orchard with the great Colleen Dewhurst.
Right.
Then it resonated for me as about a young girl who wants to leave, who wants to explore the world. Now it resonates for me as an almost 50-year-old woman of how do you deal with loss? How do you deal with things that you can't bring back? How do you deal with moving on? And it's done in a way that doesn't punch you in the face. It's a very gentle storytelling. And yet, you know, it's Chekhov does what really life is, you know, he evocates what life is all about, which is tragedy and comedy smack right up against each
right.
other, which is, let's face it, what we all deal with every day of our lives.
And no real heroes and villains, sympathetic to
everybody's
character.
Flawed.
Right.
As in life.
In this scene, actor Will LeBeau is trying to convince your character to do what he perceives to be the right thing. She ultimately sees it that way as well, but not in this scene. Let's listen.
This property is only 15 miles from town, and the railroad runs right by it. If the orchard and the property by the river were divided into lots and leased for cottages, you could clear at least 25,000 rubles a year.
Why are we listening to this?
I'm not understanding you.
You could get 25 rubles an acre, minimum. And if you advertise now, I'm willing to bet there won't be a lot left by autumn. They'll go like that. So congratulations. You're saved. I mean, you'll have to do some work around here. You know, pull down the old buildings and this house, which is of no use to anyone. And cut down the old cherry orchard.
Cut it down, my dear man. Please forgive me. But you don't know what you're talking about.
Kate Burton, she ultimately recognizes that the trees are sold. It sort of liberates her in a way.
It does liberate her. I mean, it's like anything, if you try to hold on to something that needs to go, it's going to, you know, strangle you. And I think that she comes to a realization of this. But the other thing also about Chekhov, and this happens in a lot of his plays, but particularly in this play and The Seagull, is there are options that she could have taken which might have saved her cherry orchard, and she chooses not to take them. I mean, one is that the Lopakhin character, played so beautifully by Will LeBeau, is in love with her. She has a way. I mean, in fact, if she did marry Lopakhin, she probably could keep the cherry orchard and be an extremely rich woman. So, you know, but Chekhov never gives his characters easy answers or easy ways out. What's kind of wonderful about it is everybody stays true to themselves. So, you know, as crazy, you know, Ranevskaya, my character, talks a lot about this man that she's in love with, her lover, quote-unquote lover. She's madly in love with this man who's probably really terrible for her. But for whatever reason, she's staying true to this passion that she has for him.
This love is a stone. It's hanging around my neck, but it's dragging me down. But I love this stone. And I can't live without it.
It's very exciting for me to play this kind of a character because, you know, there's this wonderful Flaubert quote, and everybody has a different translation, but basically it's like, in order to be wild and original in your work, you have to be bourgeois and kind of sedate in your life. And that's really me. I have a very, like, you know, meat and potatoes, you know, husband, two small kids. And so for me to play these crazy, wonderful, antic women is just thrilling.
You know, since you mentioned this, there's a question bubbling up. You quoted Flaubert. I'm going to paraphrase that. Mm-hmm. You know, if you live the sedate life, then it's, you can have this wildlife on stage. And I'm wondering if the equation follows that if you start to have the more outsized, crazed, mm-hmm. international life of, let's say, Richard Burton and your stepmom, mm-hmm. Elizabeth Taylor, mm-hmm. then it starts to fail on the stage
I don't know. It's so hard to tell. I mean, you know, there's no perfect equation for anybody. I mean, I just think that, you know, the beauty of growing up the way I did, which was that grew up with my dad being who he was, but I also grew up, most importantly, with my fantastic mom, is that I grew up in New York City in a terribly stable environment, and I would visit my dad in the summer times. Mm. I think it really informed the kind of person that I ended up marrying and I'm so happily married to. Because I saw the madness. The one thing, and this is an apology to all my wonderful male actor friends, I did vow to myself that I would never marry an actor.
Enough said. Before we let you go, we have to ask you about Grey's Anatomy.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't even know that was you when I snuck a peek one night. You're not old enough to play Ellen Pompeo, who's from here in the Boston area.
Yes, she is.
You're not old enough to play her mother.
No, not really. I would have had to have had her...
When you were 10.
Not 10, exactly. 13. At first, I was a little taken aback by the fact that they even were interested in me for this part because I was 46 when I got the part. And
this is a former surgeon struggling with Alzheimer's.
Early onset Alzheimer's. But now, of course, what I have discovered is that early onset Alzheimer's is huge. There was an article on the front of U.S. News and World Report about how many people in their 40s are discovering that they have Alzheimer's, except for it hasn't taken hold yet. Anyway, it's been an incredible experience. And the fact that it's become such a huge hit, it's just so surprising and makes all of us very happy.
Especially it allows you to keep doing theater.
Yes, well, that's it. Keep doing theater. And I am starting to get sort of different kinds of parts now. And I'm sort of moved to another level, which is thrilling when you're an actress.
Well, I just one last question. When you come out in your role at the Cherry Orchard here mm-hmm. at the Huntington, first of all, you just look gorgeous.
Thank you so much.
Not that you're not a very attractive
woman.
Thank
you. But
you've got this glow and
the hair.
You are an aristocrat from in the curtains with the cherry orchards on them part. And there you are in 1904.
I know.
Elegance. Yeah. And you radiate. Mm. And the audience applaud your entrance.
Oh, I know. I couldn't believe that. I was a little stunned when that happened the first time. You know what? I mean, the thing is that I can do this stuff. And listen, doing Grey's Anatomy is a wonderful experience, but I can do television, which some of it is not as so wonderful, knowing that every 6 months or at least once a year I get to do greatness. And this is, the Cherry Orchard is greatness, and also the Huntington Theater. And Nicholas Martin is my favorite director, so.
So there you go.
So there I go.
Actress Kate Burton stars in The Cherry Orchard at the Huntington Theater here in Boston. You can also catch her nationwide on Grey's Anatomy as Meredith Grey's mother, Ellis. Kate Burton, thanks so much for coming in.
You're welcome.
And here now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.